Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer Marnie Maminga is a Chicago area native, but many of her most touching words are written about her family's cabin in the North Woods of Wisconsin. We spoke with her a few years ago, in fact, about her book, Return to Wake Robin, One Cabin in the Heyday of North Woods Resorts.
Maminga's latest book is a collection of essays that includes more reminiscences of her time in the North Woods, along with the other parts of her life over the years. It's called On a Clear Night, and Marnie Maminga made the trip up to Milwaukee to chat about it. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mitch. It's great to be here. Great fun.
When did you first start writing in essay form?
Well, that's a very good question because I really had no idea what an essay was. And I was an English major in college. I must have written some essays there. But along the personal essay line, I had a series of episodes that I just thought, what do they mean and why are they sticking with me? And so I felt compelled to write them down. And so the first one that I wrote was Passing the Torch, which is about getting up to see the sunrise on the North Woods at our family's log cabin, 1929 log cabin, Wake Robin, which I wrote Return to Wake Robin, one cabin in the heyday of North Woods Resort. And that essay turned into the first chapter of that book. So then I thought, well, gosh, that worked. So I started to send out some more essays, just whatever appealed to me, to different publications, and they started to take hold. And so over the course of about several decades, I've been writing essays and enjoying the process very much.
Do you feel like the process in some way helps you make sense of the things that are going on in your life?
Exactly. I think that for some reason that moment is calling to me, but I'm not sure why. So when I write it and try to describe it, then there's some sort of epiphany along the way that I learn something, and then I hope that what I write others will relate to as well.
Well, and I wondered, since you started writing in that form, you know, over the course of a couple of decades, do you see things, not necessarily, oh, this would be a great essay, but do you, you know, sort of view real life as it goes in a different way than you might without that way to process it?
Well, a little bit, because I think when something happens to something, and usually these are ordinary experiences that just by their simplicity turn into something profound. And they seem to call to me, and I think, what just happened there? And so I am compelled to kind of write it down. So you are kind of on the alert for, does this have some meaning? And if so, maybe I'll start writing it and see where it leads, where it goes.
It's interesting. I've interviewed several doctors who are writers, and they talk about how important it is in a really stressful profession like that to be able at the end of a day or the end of a shift or the end of a week or whatever to be able to sit down just with their thoughts and try to make sense of what has happened. You know, and often what they're doing is life or death. But, you know, There are big things that happen in all of our lives.
Well, they are, and these moments, maybe they're, you know, a big thing like putting a parent in a nursing home, and or waiting for a teenager to come home from a date who's missed his curfew, or maybe something funny like trying to change a tire in a garage floor in the newfangled technology, new improved technology, and so they just kind of call to me, and I write them down, and it's fun to explore and see where they go. And I do think it's kind of a release of your emotions and good exploration of the experience. So I enjoy it.
What was it like going through all of these writings and trying to put them into a coherent book?
Well, it was fascinating because I wondered what they would look like in a manuscript. And interesting enough, they fell into these natural themes or patterns of family, friendships, nature, life changes, challenges. And it was interesting to discover the number of themes that kept repeating themselves and seemed to be important to me.
So, such as?
Well, certainly family and also life changes, you know, switching careers, leaving, kids leaving, parents leaving, friends leaving through illness or change of vocation. A lot of that had seemed to have a big effect on me. And I write about that a lot, the beauty of nature that surrounds us and how that impacts our daily lives. So,
was it a little like when you went back through these? Is it a little like going back through a photo album?
It is. And I do have a lot of photos that would go with those essays, but it is like going through a photo album. And at the time, a lot of the time I wrote about getting older, middle age, or learning to dance when you were middle age, or losing a friend, you know, as you get older. And those sort of things, I look back now and I'm going, gosh, I was really young. Why was I focused on that aging? But that sense of moving forward through life, I think, is like a photo album, a memory, a strong memory.
When do you write? When is the time right for you to sit down and actually, you know, crank out 1,000 words?
Well, I wish I could be one of those writers that said that I had a daily schedule and I, you know, the seats in the chair from 9 to 5. And I write at the coffee shop, but I'm not. I'm just a sporadic writer. I do my best work in the morning. I think I do my best thinking out for a walk or driving in the car, like coming up today. And so discipline and perseverance are really key. And sometimes a little short on that, but I do stick with it. So it gets done because I want to finish it and see where it leads.
As you go back through old writings and put them all into one coherent collection, is there a temptation to go back and change things?
You know, it was kind of fascinating to see that, no, I think that what I wrote kind of rang true, and I didn't really want to change too much. And I'm grateful my editor, a wonderful editor with Wisconsin Historical Society Press, did not either. But it was wonderful to have her vision as well, Elizabeth Wyckoff, and to see what transpired. So I felt that it was really true to the emotions that I felt at the time, the picture that I wanted to paint. And that's what I wanted to capture, that truth.
I always, you know, I've asked this question of musicians in the past when they, you know, are you know, thinking about this new album they have out and it's their, you know, 14th or 15th, and they go back and look at what they did 20 years ago or 15 years ago. Do you look back and have to be sympathetic at the writer you were in those days? Not that you weren't a good writer, but you're definitely a different writer the longer you do it. I wonder how Marnie Mominga today views the one who started writing 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Well, I think you end up with a lot more confidence. I think you start out not knowing where that essay is going to go, or that piece of music that you've composed is, where will it land? Will there be an audience? Will it ever be published? And so when those things start to happen, that gives you a little more confidence to keep going and to see what might transpire. And so it is, in a way, it's kind of self-encouragement, like, oh, that worked. Okay, I'll keep going. And it makes you want to take a little more risk, a little more step out there a little bit more and see where that leads as well. So it's a very creative and interesting journey that's very fulfilling.
When you're working on an essay and you're writing it and you're polishing it, how do you know when you're done?
Well, I am a person who rewrites and rewrites and rewrites. So I am nitpicking those words over and over and again. And finally, when I think I have a sense of peace, like I feel this is okay, I read it out loud. How does it sound? And you always are thinking, oh, should I change that word? I change that phrase. But in the end, I think you just know instinctively you're done. And at some point, you have to put it down and send it off. And that's that trust that you have to kind of, and that letting, I write a lot about letting go of them particularly. And that's not easy to do. So that's where the trust comes in.
Well, I'm going to want to have you read one of these essays for us in just a moment. But before we get to that point, let me say congratulations. This is a terrific collection, and we're thrilled that you are able to share some of it with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Mitch. I love being here, and I'm thrilled to be invited to be back. Thank you.
All right. And so you mentioned one of the essays in the interview, and it is one that I had actually dog-eared, and it is the one about changing a tire because maybe I'll have you say a little bit more about what inspired that. Obviously, there was an event that inspired that, but what were you trying to capture with
this
essay?
Well, that's entitled Owner's Manual. And actually, that is one of my favorites. I write a lot about, there's a whole section on kind of technology and my aversion to it. So when we had to change a tire on these new cars that are supposed to be new and improved technology, it was quite an adventure and frustrating one. I'm very experienced at changing tires the old way, the old-fashioned way with a jack and a, you know, a wrench. And we did that for years as children, driving up to the North Woods, watching my dad do it. We did it as teenagers ourselves. So this was a whole new experience. Thankfully, the tires don't go flat. That's a new improve that often. But when they do, it is a nightmare. So that is how this story came to be. Owner's Manual. It was a dark and stormy night. Or at least in my nightmares, it seemed that way. Actually, it was a bright and sunny day when our tire blew out. If it had been a dark and stormy night, we would have really been in trouble. It was difficult enough trying to figure out how to assemble the jack, locate the spare, and find the axle in broad daylight. Current car commercials make one think that the technical engineering of our automobiles would put them right up there with the Mars spacecraft. Alas, somewhere along this high-tech pursuit, someone forgot about keeping the jack and spare tire instructions simple. After our recent experience, I'd put changing a tire right up there with solving a Rubik's Cube. Setting off on a 20-mile trip to town from our cabin on a beautiful fall day in northern Wisconsin, my husband and I heard a weird noise coming from the right side of our car, as if we were dragging a big stick. For once in our lives, we decided not to ignore a car sound we could not identify and stopped to take a look. To our surprise, the back right tire was flatter than a run-over penny on a train track. Turning the car around, we slowly drove the half mile back to the cabin where we would be able to change the tire on the garage floor's hard surface. At least we knew that much. Like a SWAT team, the two of us searched the car for the jack and spare tire to no avail. Finally, my husband discovered the jack, located in a cleverly camouflaged compartment beneath the second row seat. It consisted of four skinny pipes that looked like Tinkerbell's wand had been in a fight and lost. My husband and I looked at each other in dismay. How the heck did this contraption fit together, and where in the world did it jack up the car? It was time to pull out the owner's manual. Oh, the shame of it, the shame! What dignified, self-respecting person ever reads the owner's manual? And while I'm at it, whatever happened to the good old days when a jack was a jack? In our defense, we are not tire-changing neophytes. We changed our first tire together as dating teenagers on another deserted Wisconsin road in the middle of a forest with only the starlight to guide us. We found the escapade hilarious. My parents, understandably, did not. In addition, I am a veteran witness to tire changing, having grown up in the 1950s when my family of seven experienced a tire blowout on virtually every annual summer vacation to the North Woods and back that I can remember. Sooner or later, on our 450-mile odyssey, the familiar thumpity-thump-thump would resound through the open windows of our packed-to-the-brim station wagon with a canoe on top. With a few swears under his breath, my father would deftly pull the car to the side of an empty country road where a cluster of cows served as our only company. But we didn't panic. We had this tire-changing nailed, so to speak. Our biggest challenge was to untie the canoe from the top of the car and unload all the luggage and vacation paraphernalia from the back end of the station wagon in order to retrieve the jack and spare. Back then, even kids knew the spare tire's location. All jacks basically looked the same and always fit next to the wheel well. And no one needed an owner's manual to assemble them, nor was there one even if you'd wanted it. With a few good cranks of the jack, the car rose up faster than a phoenix out of the ashes. A couple of good twists of the wrench, and the bolts came flying off. On went the spare, back went the bolts, back went the belongings in the canoe, and we were back on the road in a matter of hours. Child's play. Unfortunately, the old adage, "Don't fix what ain't broken," got overlooked in the computer-age tire tune-up department. And so I have to admit, we opened the owner's manual to the index and looked up jack, page 342. In a flat and halting voice that sounded like Frankenstein's, I slowly read the instructions out loud to my husband. Assemble the jack and jacking tools as shown. Connect jack handle driver A to two extensions B, then to the lug wrench C. Now, ours is not a fancy car. It is a basic American-made model, a medium-sized SUV, but I'll be danged if we couldn't identify the axle where we were instructed to fit the jack because there was so much metal hanging beneath the carriage of the car. Before long, we two grandparents, college-educated with master's degrees, were slithering under the car on the sandy garage floor like a couple of snakes. "I think I found it," I shouted. "Look at this picture on page 344. It matches." We were so happy, we thought we'd won the lottery. Luckily, in our search beneath the car, we also discovered the spare tire. What genius decided to hide it down there is beyond me, because our next quandary was how to disengage it. Back to the owner's manual, page 340. The spare tire is stowed under the rear of the vehicle by means of a cable winch mechanism. To remove or stow the spare, use the jack handle to rotate the spare tire drive nut. The nut is located under a plastic cover at the center rear of the cargo floor area, just inside the lift gate opening. There you have it. Easy as pie. As a bonus, there were enough caution warnings surrounding every direction that I felt I was entering Bill O'Reilly's no-spin zone. Somehow, we figured it out, and slowly, slowly, the spare tire floated down beneath the car like a spaceship twirling in an outer galaxy. Our sense of being in the twilight zone was complete. Eventually, we accomplished our task. The manual's parting note was to stow the tire beauty side up. This must have been an inside joke because, believe me, if there was a beauty side to the tire, I failed to recognize it. Gratefully, we were soon back on the road to town where the nice tire man informed us that our flat tire was ruined. When he replaced the spare a few days later, I watched in wonder as he whipped that tire off and put on the new one in a matter of minutes. Of course, he was using a power jack that would have shot our 2-ton car to the moon. I put one on my Christmas list. Yet, like all good nightmares, mine was not over. Recently, I bought a car seat for my 2 infant granddaughters, and a few mind-boggling attempts to connect it properly, I was beginning to think the tire changing looked easy. As frustrated as a 2-year-old and in fear of going ballistic, I once again succumbed to the instruction manual. Imagine my horror when I read, "Check vehicle owner's manual for the vehicle top tether anchor locations. They may be identified using one of the anchor's symbols, figure B or figure C. Pass the Tylenol."
That was Marnie Mominga reading her essay, Owner's Manual. It's taken from her latest book, which is called On a Clear Night, Essays from the Heartland. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Her previous book was called Return to Wake Robin.
Mominga will chat about the book and her writing tonight at Books & Company in Economowoc. There is a link to more from WUWM.com.